Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Some guests are a lot easier to introduce than others. I've known Michael Winship for 20 years, and that makes it both easy and hard. Hard to do justice to such an accomplished scholar. For my money, and it's in my wallet right here if anybody wants to wager, Michael is one of the three most distinguished bibliographers and book historians of the American book alive today. Remarkably, one of the others is in the room here with us. I've known Michael for 20 years, and he knows how to find the best barbecue in Texas. I was talking with his mother, and he told me that she did not believe that there was any bookstore in any town that Michael had ever been in that he had not visited. Michael is a bookbinder, a bibliographer, a scholar. I asked him last night when he began working on the bibliography of American literature, and he said, 75. He holds a DPhil, that's a PhD driving on the wrong side of the road. He holds a DPhil from Oxford University, which I'm told was not the Mississippi School. He studied under Donald Francis Mackenzie. His book on Ticknor and Fields is well known to all of you. His work on the history of the book in America as an editor, as a contributor, will be known to many of you. But what might not be known to all of you unless you're veterans of Rare Book School is that, like Sue Allen, Michael Winship has taught in every summer of Rare Book School since 1983. I think he was 12 when he started. It's quite remarkable. And, you know, endowed chair, professorships, visiting fellowships, publications all over the place. Sure. Listen to this from the Rare Book School evaluations. This is about the course that he's teaching now, only taught in 2008. What did you like best about the course is the question. Just the benefit of having the knowledge and experience of having the instructor. M.W. is a wonderful teacher and a scholar. It was a great opportunity to learn how to think critically about book history and book production during this historical period in America. What did you like best about the course? Michael Winship reciting poetry. Michael Winship talking. What did you like best about the course? Michael Winship. The way he conceptualized and explained historiography and intellectual inventions without pretension. What did you like best about the course? Michael Winship is a gifted scholar and lecturer whose passion for his subject shines through. I would have to say that it was his style and delivery that I liked best. What did you like best about the course? Michael Winship and his teaching, or rather, his great depth and experience and knowledge, which came through at every point. What did you like best about the course? I am always stirred by M.W.'s depth of knowledge and breadth of experience. A scholarly, practical, and human perspective inform everything he says. What a scholar. What a teacher. What a man. Most importantly, he offers something very valuable to literature people, a lifeline from book history back to the reasons we read and love books in the first place. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Winship. That would be embarrassing if I hadn't written all that myself. It's a great pleasure to be back here. What? Can you hear or not? Closer. Okay. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening, and it's going to ring. This is always a good crowd to talk to, because I think, at least I hope, that you have a shared interest with me. Though I did, the last time I spoke here, I carefully arranged that everybody would have a copy of a book to read in case they didn't like the talk. They'd have something. And I'm sure some did read. The talk I'm giving tonight is based on material that's forthcoming in the next issue of Studies in Bibliography. And I put it together a little bit quickly. So I recommend on Friday you can actually sign up and join the Bibliographical Society of the University of Virginia, and that volume will arrive in your mailbox for free, and then you can see what I was really trying to say if I said it. The difference tonight, of course, is that I do have some pictures to show you, and that you might think that you're getting the better end of the bargain, except once you see my pictures, you'll see that they're of such poor quality that maybe it isn't so good, and I apologize for that, but many of the pictures that I put into this were not really pictures that I took for the purpose of illustrating this slide. But were taken for my own research use. And I guess finally, just as a preliminary, I need to apologize to the at least two members of the audience who have either read or heard earlier versions of this talk. I don't know that it's getting any better with age. But here we go. Thank you. Now, are you going to do the lights?
Yes.
Why don't we see what the lights do for us? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
There. Yeah, I think that's okay. At this point, usually the binder's warehouse, the publisher has books. And at that point is the book buyer. Between these two points is the tragedy of the book industry. This statement is taken from O.H. Cheney's 1931 economic survey of the book industry. Cheney, a banker who had been commissioned by the National Association of Book Publishers to survey the state of the book industry, continues in the same vein. Between these two points, the publisher and the book buyer, are so many gaps, so many confusions, so much utter ignorance of what is being done, that unless these gaps are filled, and unless every branch of the industry learns to know exactly what it is doing, the industry as it is today is threatened with destruction. All in all, he concludes, mourning, with a U, becomes the book industry. What happened here? Okay, there we go. Dire words indeed. Nevertheless, I would echo Cheney by suggesting it is the study of book distribution that may well be the tragedy of American book history. A lively field over the past decades, as literary and historical scholars have come to recognize that the dual role of books as both commodities and carriers of culture makes them important to any understanding of our literature, culture, economy, and society. These book historians have explored the importance of books in shaping American culture and society, but they have generally focused on the role of authors, publishers, and readers, while ignoring the fundamental question of just how texts and books found their way from creator to market. Indeed, book historians and literary critics both appear to have assumed that the books written by authors and issued by publishers
reached their readers seamlessly and with no mediation. They have paid next to no attention to the mechanisms of book distribution or to how these mechanisms determine the availability of books and thus the kind of reading that the American public engaged in. I think this oversight is particularly ironic for the very few book historians who have considered the question of book distribution in the United States have often taken Cheney and his report as an important source, without, it seems, considering the import that Cheney's conclusions might hold for their own work. I can only imagine that the report's presentation, as a banker, Cheney filled his works with tables and graphs and charts, lent it an air of authority, while the implications of its data and the economic moment in which it was prepared have been ignored. Was Cheney really correct in his conclusions? Was book distribution truly the tragedy of the American book industry? If so, how can we make sense of the fact that book distribution has been so little studied or written about? These are difficult questions, but unless they are answered, our understanding of a central feature of the American book of American book history will remain incomplete and inadequate. Accordingly, for the past few years, I have been engaged in researching and writing a history of book distribution in the United States from about 1825 into the 20th century, in which I will argue that by about 1850, our familiar national trade book publishing system had emerged, marketing its publications across the country through an extensive array of independent, dedicated bookstores. In the course of my researches, I have discovered that the primary source materials for the study of American book distribution are few and widely scattered. And where they do survive, their importance is often overlooked or misunderstood. For example, one valuable source, one on which I will focus this evening, are national directories of American bookstores that were published for the use of the book trade and that document the extent of the national network of dedicated retail outlets for books. And this is one by my hero, Todd H. Dingman, from the late, 1870. In many cases, these directories contain not only names and addresses, but also an indication of the size of a bookstore's business and their creditworthiness, information that would have been of great use to publishers in filling orders from distant places. The information that they contain also allows us to begin to form a better understanding of the American book distribution system and to establish whether it was indeed, as Cheney would have it, the tragedy of the book industry. A much larger number of these directories were produced than I at first imagined, in part because their survival is so uncommon. Many exist today in only one or two copies, and others have disappeared completely. Between 1830 and the turn of the century, at least 35 directories of American bookstores were proposed or published, supplemented by four that were restricted to shops that dealt in antiquarian or secondhand books. Between 1900 and 1950, a further 31 directories of general booksellers appeared, and five for dealers in antiquarian or secondhand books. As far as I can tell, these directories have never been systematically examined or analyzed either by American book historians or, for that matter, by anyone else. Two early lists of American booksellers deserve attention, though an examination of these lists shows that, in general, they use the term bookseller in its early sense that does not clearly distinguish dedicated booksellers from those who in the 19th century were increasingly becoming to be known as publishers. The first, list of booksellers in the principal cities and towns in the United States appeared in December 1834 issue of the Booksellers Advertiser, a pioneering but short-lived book trade journal edited by the young George Palmer Putnam. 14 years later, in 1848, Alexander V. Blake included a list of publishers and booksellers in the different states, cities, and towns as far as returned to the compiler July 1848 in the supplement to his American Booksellers Complete Reference Trade List. You see what I mean about the quote. This is, as you can see in the lower right-hand corner, lifted right off Google. That same month, by the 1850s, the need for a directory of American booksellers and bookstores proper had become widely recognized. In the earliest surviving issue, that of June 1851, of another early book trade journal, one that was simply entitled The Book Trade, its editor, H. Wilson, states his intention, quote, to commence shortly the publication of a list of all the booksellers in the United States and Canada, whose names and post office address we may be able to obtain alphabetically arranged. He continues with a plea to postmasters, publishers, booksellers for any information of the names and addresses of others in the trade in their neighborhood. As far as I know, nothing came of this plan. That same month, June 1851, Charles B. Norton, editor of yet another early book trade journal, with the title of Norton's Literary Advertiser, claimed to have in his possession the most accurate and extensive lists both of booksellers and reading institutions in our country. For the inaugural issue of the Advertiser, published the preceding month, Norton says he had intended to publish 2,000 copies, but discovered that before going to press, it was apparent that a larger edition would be required, and consequently 3,000 were struck off. But, he continues, already in this number, this is the second number, already this number is too small to supply the demand, and of the present sheet, 4,000 copies have been printed. This gives some sense of the extent of his list of subscribers, many of whom must have been booksellers. There is no indication that Norton intended to publish this list, although in a notice of March 1854 in the Advertiser's Successor, he advertises his services to use his list to address circulars, trade lists, catalogs, etc., to the trade at the rate of $5 per thousand. So at this point, one imagines that he is has an audience for his journal of 4,000 to 5,000 perhaps, and maybe half of those were bookstores, others being libraries, and who knows who. But 2,000, anyway. On the 1st of September 1854, D. Hannigan of New York, the publisher of yet another early book trade journal, this time with the name The Booksellers Trade List and Publishers Register, issued a call for subscription for his private edition of a classified directory of the booksellers, stationers, cheap publication sellers of the United States, West Indies, British, and South America, limited to 50 copies at the price of $35. This directory was promised to be late, complete, and reliable, and was to be printed in quarto form on $16 paper. That's the cost of the paper per ream, long primer type with alternate blank pages for additions, alterations, remarks, etc., and bound in sheep with spring backs. Hannigan may never have completed and issued this directory, though this seems unlikely. In his call for subscriptions, he claims that 23 of the 50 are already taken up. Whatever the case, I have been unable to find a copy today. On the other hand, the earliest surviving bookstore directory appeared 5 years later and shares many characteristics with Hannigan's. It was to be made available by subscription at a very high price in limited numbers. O.A. Rohrbach, Orville A. Rohrbach's list of booksellers in the United States and the Canadas, was published in New York City in March 1859. Printed on 128 pages, this directory lists 3,126 sellers of books in some 1,100 towns. Oops. There we go. This is the first page. Arranged alphabetically from Abbeville, North Carolina, one general store that stocked only school books and served a population of 400, to Zanesville, Ohio, four booksellers that served a population of 12,000. Only two copies of Rohrbach's book, this is the copyright deposit copy at the Library of Congress, can be located today. Rohrbach is chiefly remembered, if he is remembered, for a different pioneering work, his Bibliotheca Americana, a catalog of American publications, including reprints and original works from 1820 inclusive. This is the sort of first attempt at an American, or it's one of the early attempts at an American books in print. That was first issued exactly 10 years before his bookstore directory, in March 1849. Rohrbach was born at Red Hook Landing on the Hudson River in January of 1803. He entered the book trade in 1817 as an employee of one of New York's leading booksellers, Everett Dykink, whom he effectively succeeded in 1825 after purchasing a large portion of the stock. In 1830, Rohrbach moved to Charleston, South Carolina, but returned to New York City in about 1848 to take charge of the wholesale department at Wiley and Putnam. In 1852, he set up on his own as jobber and publisher, but failed, as so many did, in the Panic of 1857. July of 1858, Rohrbach began publication of the twice-monthly Booksellers Medium and Publishers Advertiser, another trade journal, and completed three volumes before his death in June of 1861. The earliest notice of Rohrbach's directory of booksellers appeared in his journal, The Booksellers Medium. The issue for 1 January 1859 contains an announcement and call for subscriptions to the work, which was to be published in only 100 copies at the pre-publication price of $25. The announcement describes the work as follows. The list embraces some 1,100 cities and towns containing about 3,000 names, 2,100 of which make books and stationery their exclusive business. The remainder are general dealers who keep school books only and druggists who combine books as a part of their business. He goes on to explain that he had compiled the list by direct communication with every city and town and with the collaboration of 8 of the largest publishers of New York City. It may have been this announcement and the high cost and limited number of Rohrbach's publication that inspired the American Publishers Circular and Literary Gazette, and I promise that's the last early trade journal I'll mention, a rival trade journal published by the New York Book Publishers Association to announce a competing directory of American booksellers. There, the issue of 5 February of 1859 printed the following notice to booksellers. We propose to publish during the present year a complete list of all booksellers in the United States and Canada, undertaking the task for the benefit of our readers, who will thus be enabled to obtain a correct list of all booksellers in the United States and Canada without any cost whatsoever. Rohrbach responded in the Booksellers Medium. After reprinting this notice, he wishes the American publisher's circular Godspeed, but then continues to suggest that a free list is worth exactly what it costs. As publishers are unlikely to give their customer information away, he points out that the number of subscribers to the circular was only 700, whereas the circulation of the bookseller's medium was 4,700, and appends to this note a list of 23 firms that had already subscribed to his directory, firms located in Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Springfield, Massachusetts, and Cincinnati. Rohrbach's list became available in March or early April and was announced as now ready in the bookseller's medium of 15 April at a post-publication price of $40. Only $100 copies printed, he says, and less than 30 copies remain on hand, unsold. But the reception was apparently not completely positive, for in the issue of June 1859, Rohrbach printed a long note with the heading, "To the subscriber to Rohrbach's list of booksellers." And I'll just extract a little bit. "We do not claim that our book is perfect, but do claim that every name on the list, with the exception of 9 miss inserted to secure copyright," he had made up 9 fake ones. So if you stole the information, he could show that you had, "were in business on or since May 1858. During this period, we have communicated by autograph letter with more than 2,700 towns and with great pleasure acknowledge the replies, which was fully 95% of the whole, giving much collateral information, though only about 1,300 towns gave the names of firms approximating to the name of booksellers." So this gives a sense of how he had compiled it, and he's really... I mean, a book that's $40 at this time is not a book. He's basically selling information. And that's what he's trying to guarantee. In the meanwhile, the American Publisher's Circular had not been idle. Let's see. And in the issue of 6 August 1859, published a 2-page list of the booksellers in the New England states. And there you can see, I hope you can kind of make out how this list is arranged. This was the first of 4 such lists. Those for the middle states, southern states, and western states followed in September 1859 and March 1860, respectively, carefully designed to coincide with the gathering of booksellers and publishers for the trade sales in New York City. A note in the issue with the initial installment explains that the list had been prepared with no little labor and expense, but not saying exactly how, and that it was believed to be more accurate than any similar list in the country. Following the final installment, the circular, or the editor of the circular, announces, "We gave in our last issue a list of booksellers in the western states, which, with those already published, complete the list for the United States. In order to make it as accurate as possible in view of future corrected publication, we hope that our friends will promptly advise us of any errors or omissions of whatever character which they may discover." The notice then continues, and this is, I think, very interesting. "On comparison of the different states, it will be perceived that the proportion of booksellers in accordance with population is not always preserved. This may be accounted for by the fact that in some states, bookselling is a part of the business of nearly every country store, while in others, the business is concentrated in centers and in a great degree confined to the bookseller exclusively. It has been entirely impossible to exercise any such discrimination in the list we have prepared. And in regard to the small dealers who unite the sale of books with other business, Neither R nor any list can be depended upon for entire thoroughness. But in regard to the regular dealers, the regular booksellers, those whose business is of any considerable importance, we feel confident that our list is very full and as perfect as may be reasonably expected. As he had earlier, Rohrbach reprinted extracts from this notice at his bookseller's medium. He remained skeptical, however, and comments facetiously that the lack of discrimination confessed by the circular, quote, accounts for Illinois having about as many booksellers as all the New England states, together, excepting Massachusetts. Nevertheless, he promises his subscribers that in accordance with our rule of placing the medium in every channel where advertisers are likely to find results, our paper is sent in detachments to every name on this, quote, most perfect list, not included on our own. We, of course, anticipate the receipt of something less than a peck of those yellow missives endorsed free post office business not taken out, which is their way of saying addressee unknown. The rhetoric displayed here fascinates me, as it reflects different understandings, competitive and cooperative, of how the book trade should work. This dispute also raises the important question of just what kind of retail establishments these two lists were documenting. Rohrbach's list provides a key that is suggestive. He lists publishers, booksellers, periodical dealers, dealers in drugs and books, stationers, general dealers who carry school books, and a considerable number that are classified as dealers who handle books to, quote, to what degree unreported. Explaining this final category, he adds that many are doubtless regular booksellers, yet it was not considered advisable to assume anything, even if the locality and population of the towns will enable the intelligent bookseller to make a fair guess as to the probabilities. What is noteworthy, however, I think, is the large number of retail outlets by 1859 that were claimed to have made books and stationery their exclusive business, about 2,100, according to Rohrbach. In just what these... Just what these dedicated retail bookstores were like, which and how many books they stocked, and how they were arranged and presented is difficult to know exactly, though early depictions of the interior of American bookstores are suggestive. Most carried a variety of goods in addition to books and stationery, including games, fancy goods, and such things as razors or musical instruments, even as they identified themselves chiefly as bookstores. With the exception of popular or new books laid out on tables, the book stock itself was chiefly inaccessible to customers, and it seems usually shelved by publisher rather than subject. Thus, customers must have relied on clerks not only for advice, but also for access to most books. Perhaps much in the way that we do today when we shop for shoes. Though window displays and posted advertising show bills would have been drawn attention to new publications. Now I'm going to break here and show you a kind of gallery of interiors of 19th century bookstores. Well, we'll just have some fun. This is the earliest one I know, from the 1830s. I mean, there are earlier ones, but this, and this is presumably a kind of generic bookstore, but it shows you the counter and the books behind the counter and the clerk. And also, another thing that it took me a long time to recognize this, but you, in general, the clerks are not wearing their hats and the customers are wearing their hats, as though this is a kind of liminal space. It's inside and outside both. And you'll see that. This is, I do not know the date of this. It's Concord, New Hampshire, John F. Brown, and you can kind of see in through the windows and wonderful shipments of books arriving on the street, and you get a kind of list of the advertising. And this is a trade card for the same bookstore, Concord, New Hampshire. That's about an inch and a half by 3/4 of an inch or something. So. Okay. This is 1850. This is a shop in New Albany, Indiana, across the river from Louisville, which in 1850, that river was an important boundary between, of course, Kentucky, which was a slave state, and Indiana, that was not. Again, I won't take time to read it, but it's interesting because it shows you all the things that they stock. And also, of course, it says Western dealers supplied with all the publications of Lippincott, Grambo and Company. Lippincott in Philadelphia at that time is said to have been the largest wholesaler of books in the world. And maybe he was. These are actually letterheads. And in this one, you can actually sort of see into the bookshop. And there's a blow up. And that's you can see here that there's curved pieces of metal with the drain pipe running behind it, grates on the sidewalk, and then this long, deep, they're wearing their hats, so they must be customers. Mm-hmm. And on those metal, that's where you would post your show bills. And here is a 1860s Lippincott show bill that they must be very hard to find these. And a colored one, too. This is Baltimore, 1854, roughly. And he's put his hat on the counter. This is Appleton's in New York City. I don't really know the date, but early 1850s. And one of the things interesting is new English books, London books. Appleton's did a lot of business in importing books. And then Appleton's moved uptown into what had formerly been the New York Mercantile Library. And that's their new space. Appleton's was one of the big, big book, both booksellers and wholesalers of this period. That's rather grand, actually. This is John P. Jewett in Boston, the publisher of Uncle Tom's Cabin. He moved into a new store several years after publishing Uncle Tom's Cabin. And this is John P. Jewett's new and spacious bookstore, number 117 Washington Street. This, I think, is a delivery boy heading out to deliver a book to a customer with his friendly dog. Skylights and then gaslight. Oops. This is a New York City bookstore at the end of the 50s. It's D.W. Evans and Company, Broadway. This is the same company a little bit later, and you can see here advertisements for J.H. Ingraham's books, The Prince of the House and Pillar of Fire on the wall, and then paintings up there and books up there, and that's all behind glass. The trees. This is actually the brother of the Evans in New York. This is G.G. Evans in Philadelphia, again, late 50s, maybe 1860. And then that's another shot, this wonderful chromolithograph of G.G. Evans in Philadelphia. And I'd love to be able... Who is that one? And that looks like it could be Shakespeare. And so on busts along there. This is in Cincinnati, Ricky Mallory and Company, exclusive Western agents for the extensive and valuable list of D. Appleton and Harper and Brothers, etc., etc. There's a blow up of that picture. Then this is Lee and Shepard's in Boston. Again, I've not been able to date. Actually, I don't know where the source, what the source of this picture is. It's reproduced in a 20th century book. But I think it must be in the late 60s. This is another Boston D. Lothrop and Company, publishers and booksellers. And there's the inside of D. Lothrop and Company. And there now are a series of Scribner views. Interior view of the sale room of Charles Scribner and Sons. And there's a photograph. And then general view of another. This is actually a different store. They'd moved up Broadway. This is also Scribner's. This is the interior of the old corner bookstore in Boston. By now we're in the late 1880s. And then this is on the poster. This is Lippincott's in Philadelphia in early 1890s. He's wishing he was with you. And look, he's eyeing that young woman. And this kid looks kind of like he wishes he were so well. This is Cleveland, again in the 1890s. And then I think I have three pictures of women and children in bookstores. And I'll tell you before I show you, it's all about hats and umbrellas. This is, I don't know, in the 1850s. A children's book. There you go, the cheap French fiction. Books for children. This is actually in the early 20th century, 1908 or something like that. So, where was I? Oh, yes, showbills, yes. Now, in rural areas, outside cities and towns where the population could not support such a dedicated bookstore as I've been showing you, a few books, of course, as we've heard, would have been available in country general stores. Even in cities and towns, many must have depended on news agents, friends, and especially as the century progressed, libraries and department stores for their reading material. Some book buyers must have ordered directly from publishers, receiving their purchases by mail, and others may have employed friends or agents in the major publishing centers to assist in their book purchases. But I believe that dedicated independent bookstores, exactly of the kind that these directories document, had, by 1850 to 1860, become the backbone of the regular American trade book distribution system. Now, the early rise of a national book distribution system in the United States, depending on bookstores, as documented by the directories, is something of a surprise. For by the 1850s, the very same time that this is emerging, the publishing industry was coincidentally becoming increasingly concentrated in three major East Coast cities, Philadelphia, Boston, and especially New York. Just as the New York, United States was becoming more extensive, growing to stretch across the entire North American continent. The rise of the dedicated independent bookstore seems to have been an important development of the antebellum decades, however, for there was nothing similar in the first decades of the antebellum of the 19th century. Into the 1820s, or at least Jim Green assures me this is true, every bookseller whose trade appears to be confined to retailing books and stationery turns out, on closer examination, also to be involved in printing, publishing, wholesaling, or bookbinding, at least occasionally, or else the bookseller served as an agent for an urban publisher. would it not have made more sense for there to have risen an expanding network of interdependent regional markets for books, supporting publishers and retailers that continued the pattern that was characteristic of the early decades of the 19th century? To some extent, this earlier system did persist. Certainly, this is true of newspapers, many of which, even today, if they actually survive today, are regional or local in nature. But what is striking about the book industry is that it, especially that part of the book industry that is concerned with what have come to be called trade books, became truly national in character. The contradiction between the concentration of book publication and production industry in the East and the expansion of the market for books across the continent is a defining characteristic of the modern American book trade, and is surely the primary explanation for why Cheney refers to book distribution as the tragedy of the book industry. In order to function effectively, a national book distribution system needed to develop means for managing the transportation of books to buyers from the centers of publication, as well as for the efficient exchange of information and transfer of credit. Just how that happened is something that historians of the American book have not yet adequately addressed, but the directories that I've been discussing do suggest that by the 1850s, the American book trade was, at the very least, beginning to address these issues. So, what are we to make of Cheney's 1931 characterization of American book distribution system as a tragedy, in danger of bringing the book industry to the brink of extinction? Cheney's pessimism is perhaps understandable, given that he was writing at the beginning of the Great Depression of the 1930s. Yet the book industry survived, carrying on in much the same way as it had for many years. Elsewhere in his study, Cheney is more qualified and less colorful. On the one hand, despite his many recommendations for improvement, Cheney found himself unable to offer any plan for transforming the book industry into big business overnight. And he admits that no single major solution is possible. The recommendations he does make suggest not a broad-based reorganization of the book industry, but rather means by which the existing book distribution system might be changed to effect greater efficiency and profit. And on the other hand, he explains that in the conditions pictured in this report, the book industry is like every other American industry, and that no industry in the country is in a position to gloat over the book industry. Taking the long view from, say, 1850 to 1950, and considering the considerable growth in the American economy over that period, it does not seem reasonable to me to view American industry, or the book industry for that matter, in such an unfavorable light. If they were broken, they managed to function remarkably well over the long term. Of course, Cheney's analysis does raise the imponderable question of just what would have been a more successful book distribution system. Cheney himself was unable to offer a real alternative, although the history of the book in America offers several. Most important are the various subscription schemes, from the use of door-to-door canvassers that flourished in the years after the Civil War to the many book clubs that used the mails for distribution and that first emerged in the 1920s. Subscription publishing has been a persistent feature of the American book trade from colonial times, and while they have certainly supplemented the national book trade distribution system that depended on bookstores, they never succeeded in supplanting it. If the American book distribution system came to depend on bookstores, how successful were these retail stores in reaching the extensive market for books in the United States? An answer to that question will only emerge from a full analysis of the directories of bookstores and other sources. As far as I know, there were no similar directories that document the presence of, say, dedicated shoe stores throughout the United States before 1950. I must qualify that. Just several weeks ago, I did find a shoe store directory. But the thought that there might be raises a useful comparison. No doubt, there were many villages and small towns that lacked a single shoe store. But this situation can scarcely suggest that most rural Americans have gone unshod all these years. Of course, many Americans may have chosen not to wear shoes, either by choice or from lack of means. But I doubt that most could not have done so if they had wished. I suspect that the same is true of books. The distribution system for books may not have been completely efficient, as Cheney noted, but it was probably effective. Those who wished to read undoubtedly found ways to find the books that they wanted. Today, at the beginning of the 21st century, the United States does seem to be undergoing a reorganization of our book distribution system, driven by improved means, chiefly digital, of information and inventory control, and by an influx of corporate capital. The result has been the increasing dominance of chain bookstores located in malls, freestanding corporate superstores, and especially internet book distributors like Amazon.com. Our reaction to these changes has been ambivalent, and we are all familiar with the many nostalgic laments over the loss of many of our independent retail bookstores. But this ambivalence is not new. In 1952, the American Booksellers Association distributed a booklet by Adolf Kroah entitled "Bookstores Can Be Saved, 14 Proposals Answering the Question, What is Wrong with the Bookstores?" Perhaps we should, taking our cue from Cheney, withhold judgment about Amazon and other modern developments, for I suspect that today we all benefit from greater access to the products of the American book industry than ever before. But I also believe that the directory of booksellers that I have been discussing provide convincing evidence that the earlier trade book distribution system, established in the decades before the Civil War and centered on the bookstore, functioned effectively for over 150 years. Thank you.
Michael, thank you very much indeed. I believe we bring the lights up and we all sort of more light and light, more dark and dark our woes. Then if we do, then perhaps we might ask a few questions and
a few months.
I think we must. We must.
Please.
Could you say something about the postal system and the carriage system that's driving this, that's making this be able to work?
One word, express or two words, express companies.
Mm-hmm. Is that how it's working?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is true that publishers frequently offered to send single copies of books through the mail, and undoubtedly they did this, but this was not an effective way of distributing books, and of any particular edition of a book, there's no evidence that just a very few copies were distributed through the mails directly to individuals. The bookstores complained about it as saying that the publishers are competing with the bookstores, but that's not particularly important. But what is important, are the middlemen. Of course, the laying of the rail network is of course important, but most books are not very well qualified to walk down to the depot, buy a ticket, get on, and then remember to get off at the right place. That's what the express companies did.
and the express companies start up. I mean, they're almost, it's almost coincidental with the growth of the rail network. I mean, they're just clearly just linked. And the early 40s are the earliest sort of establishments of express companies. And I mean, the same thing today. I mean, could Amazon work without FedEx or UPS or whatever it is? Well, maybe, because the U.S. mail system, I mean, you know, that's possible. But Amazon couldn't work, actually, without that barcode. That's what makes Amazon work, is the fact that they can do computer inventory control. But that's... Yes?
Michael Pollan, isn't that the case, though, that so the publishers complain, or the booksellers complain against the publishers about fulfilling these odd orders, but isn't that what the booksellers themselves were doing? If I wanted a book and I lived in...
Well, of course it is. Right. But you see, that, I mean...
Wasn't that maybe effective enough that you were getting at, that a few booksellers, a few large bookstores in cities could supply me through advertisements and magazines and the rest, things that I wanted to read, or...?
Well, I mean, well, two things. I mean, this is just sort of an ongoing debate. The booksellers, in theory, want the system where publishers publish and retailers retail. And when publishers retail, they think that's unfair. Now, many of these bookstores, and you'll see this if we went back to the Nunemaker, the Albany, New Albany, Indiana, he advertises himself as retail and wholesale bookseller. And what they are really doing, they are retailing, they're full retailers, but they are also hoping to supply the general stores and the local library, and if they can get away with it, they'd like to handle text school books for the local schools. Though that was always a bit iffy, because they were both retail. Many of the ones that you can actually document are these sort of, they are retail booksellers, but they're also wholesale booksellers for their region. But, for instance, in Austin, Texas, and I cut out just for the sake of, I hope, not keeping you too late, because you all want dinner after today, a section on book buying in Austin, Texas, which, you know, is a very small town in the 1850s, already has three booksellers. And I've learned quite a lot about these booksellers. I know which ones of them own slaves and things like that. And one of them was really a drugstore that carried some books. So it's, but they're not wholesaling particularly beyond Austin, though they may be supplying customers in the area around that. Yes?
I'm curious about banking system and credit.
I wish I could answer that, and I wish I could answer it very briefly. I suppose one thing to say is that it's somewhat different before the Civil War, when the American currency was federalized. That seems to have made a difference. It was difficult, is all I can say. And frequently, I mean, for those customers that do write in through the mails, I think we think there were more of them because they leave a trace. Those letters survive. But you try to count how many people ordered any particular book, and you just see it's not important. They often sent postage stamps as currency for, you know, small amounts because they didn't have a bank account to write a check on. And, of course, a check on an out-of-state bank was not particularly negotiable. For a long time. I mean, as the century goes on, it becomes increasingly easy. But, I mean, I remember when I first started coming to Charlottesville to do research on the Barrett collection, if I didn't bring traveler's checks, I had two choices. I could go to the bank and write a check and wait a week for it to clear, or I could go to my friend who was on the faculty here and have him guarantee my check at the bank with his money. And that, I mean, that wasn't that many years ago. I mean, we've gotten so used to, electronic credit and the flow, easy flow of credit. And that was, I mean, that's a very new thing, that an out-of-state check, well, you could pay anything with that. Anyway, yes?
Where do libraries fit into this?
Libraries are libraries typically try to buy from wholesalers. Mm-hmm. Libraries typically try to get a little bit of a extra break, discount, and in general, wholesalers tend to be quite will give that. I mean, of course, libraries as a term covers a lot of different kinds of institutions. And again, the local retailers always thought we should get the local library business. And the library administration usually thinks, well, if we write to Boston and deal with Lee and Sheppard, they'll give us 5%, we'll pay a little less. And it's a system that's imperfect. And these are the kinds of things that bug Cheney a great deal. The fact that both things could happen, There are other questions? Yes?
Thanks for your talk, by the way. But I was interested in the sort of working dynamic you were saying between competitivism and this cooperation that was happening that you saw in the directories.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the Facebook bookstore slide had this sort of associational cooperative thing. And Matthew Carey in the early 19th century association.
Right.
Together. But an independent retail bookstore as kind of dominant mode of distribution can't really operate in a fully cooperative setting, right? There has to be that
I mean, when times are good, it's easy to cooperate. When times are bad, you are trying to undersell your neighbor because you need the money.
Do you think the fact that those directories focus most on getting the input and
Those directories are, the cooperative directory. Dingman's is an interesting one, but it certainly ends up being basically in this vein of this is for the good of the trade. And there's one by a Milwaukee publisher in 1889, C.N. Casper, that was actually, I think, kind of in partnership with Publishers Weekly. That's clearly a cooperative one. But most of them are purely profit-driven things. And a lot of them work like... One of the reasons they're so scarce is that they contain what was thought of as privileged information about credit. And they have the standard form, which is... This book remains the property of the publisher. It's only, it's leased by you. You may not share the information or pass the book along. And then they're numbered so that if you did, they could tell who they sold it to. And then it says you have to return that copy to get the next year's one. And I in the studies and bibliography article, I have a checklist of all of these directories. And when I started, I just despaired of ever seeing a great number of them until I discovered that, of course, they sent them to the Library of Congress for copyright because the information was so valuable. And for reasons that still puzzle me, the Library of Congress kept them. So suddenly, in 1 week, I suddenly saw maybe 25 directories that I knew about but had never been able to see a copy of. Yes?
In our collection, we have a publisher's dummy.
Yes?
I'm not quite sure how to present that as an artifact that sheds light on some aspect of the American book trade. And I'm wondering if you can help me out with that.
Well, I'm guessing, but I don't know because I haven't seen it, that what you have is a canvassing book for a subscription publication.
It's like the first page of each chapter. chapter. It would have been an expense that...
Yeah, that's what I think you probably have. And this is, what I would recommend is looking at the preface to a catalog of these canvassing books that's written by Keith Arbour. It's called the Michael Zinman Collection of Canvassing Books or something. I'm sure there is a copy somewhere around the Rare Book School. And he in his preface to that collection gives a nice overview of the whole process. But I mean, without seeing it, I can only guess what you have. But that's what it sounds like to me. And those books, by the way, were specifically not sold in bookstores.
Oh well.
Exactly. Except they were sold in bookstores, but that's what they're. But they weren't supposed to be. Yes.
These early directories seem to be geared towards people that are trying to sell stuff to these shops. But in the 20th century, you get directories that are geared towards customers who might be traveling around looking at bookstores. When did that start?
Well. Presumably all, I mean, the earliest that I know of, okay, I'm assuming that most bookstores in the 19th century, or many bookstores in the 19th century, had both new and used books in them, or secondhand books in them. But the first dedicated directory to antiquarian or secondhand books is 1885, and I think that to some extent was going to be aimed at customers, and certainly a number of them that, I mean, the emphasis on antiquarian or used books I think is much more customer based. In terms of looking for bookstores, I mean, I think the main purpose of these bookstores was for publishers to define their market. In the 20th century, once Bowker gets involved in publishing them, usually these lists of bookstores are only part of the volume, and there'll be lists of publishers and other information like that, and it becomes something like the literary marketplace, and it becomes a reference book that is used by a number of different people because it has a variety of information in it. I guess that's the best I can say on that.
Please take out a half sheet of paper and write what you liked best about the lecture. Please join me in thanking Michael for his service. In token of our appreciation, Michael, we'd like to give you the poster for your talk.
Oh my goodness.
And a little thank you note from the staff. We're extremely grateful to you. I'm sure that Michael would love to speak with you further at our reception, which will take place in Alderman Library in the room where we had the reception last night. Wine, cheese, maybe even a couple of beers or so. And I invite you to join us there. Thank you very much indeed.